ideology.
Tenure.
Coffee.
Light bulb.
Critique.
Methods.
Dysentery.
Lavish.
Corduroy.
Research.
You are listening to.
You're listening to.
Prof Talk.
On CITR.
Thank you very much.
Good morning and welcome to Prof Talk on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. I'm your host, Karen Moxley. Today we are going to listen to an interview that Carrie Blackadar did last spring with a former UBC student. Amy Osborne is now working towards becoming a doctor, but she completed her bachelor's at UBC in 2006. After graduating, she left for Darfur to work as a midwife with Doctors Without Borders. Here to introduce the interview is Carrie. Hello, Carrie.
Hello, Karen. Darfur is a place that many of us have heard of, but I don't think many of us know or choose to know it well. Several years ago, an Oxfam employee called Darfur a forgotten emergency. Since 2003, armed conflict between rebel groups and the Sudanese government and their Arab allies has forced millions to flee their homes. The UN believes the death toll now sits in the hundreds of thousands. The infant mortality rate is 82 deaths for every 1,000 live births. And to give you an idea of how large this number is, in Canada, the infant mortality rate sits at around 5. By the end of January, it's expected that peace talks will resume in Darfur, although in the past, peace treaties have been largely ignored. Last year, Amy Osborne visited UBC to speak to a class that I was taking with Professor Judy McLean, who works under the Faculty of Land and Food Systems here at UBC. McLean teaches students about global problems in nutrition and issues of food security. Amy was once a student of Professor McLean's and actually made the decision to go to Darfur after watching a film that was screened in class. Amy is not a professor at UBC, but she certainly deserves to be listened to, and so I hope you enjoy. Amy, can you start by just telling me a little bit about your background?
I did my degree in midwifery in Texas, finished in 99, went to the Philippines, did a few trips there, so about a year and a half, 2 years altogether. Went to Afghanistan in 2003 as a midwife, and between trips coming back here and working on my undergrad at UBC, and finished my undergrad at UBC in 2006, went to Darfur as a midwife, and then started med school in 2007, and doing that now.
And what do you remember from your very first trip overseas?
My first trip overseas, I did a year in the Philippines. So we worked in the slums. Actually, our area was called the Killing Fields. And the Philippines has massive maternal and child mortality rates. So, and also, you know, the area we were in, no one could afford medical care. So we were really busy all the time. Lots of deliveries, lots of complications, lots of, you know, things that you would never see here or be able to handle here as a midwife. So it was pretty life-altering to be so immersed, like to live in the slums and like be in that world.
And when you decided to go to Darfur in 2006, what did you expect it to be like?
I don't even really know what I expected or what I thought was going on. I had seen an episode of ER, actually, the night that I was deciding whether or not to go. And so I had an idea of the camps and the violence and you know, them raping the women, but I had only seen that one episode. I didn't realize that it was so prevalent. I thought it was just like a storyline. I knew that it was going to be a genocide and that it was horrible conditions, but I was also going there under the impression that it was, they'd signed the peace treaty, which they had, but by the time I got there, within a month, the government was bombing them again.
Can you tell me a little bit about the area that you stayed in?
I was in a camp that was, I think maybe 25,000. Yeah, I think it was about that. But it was a different camp. It wasn't typical. It was the usual IDP camps. You had a village, and then outside of the village, you had the camps. Whereas in Habila, where I was, the people of Habila took in the IDPs and integrated them into their village. So it was very hard to tell who was an IDP and who was from the village. But the village had swelled like to 5 times its natural size.
And how big was the team you were with?
We had a team of 5 expats, and then we had a huge national staff. But as far as, I mean, in our compound, there were 5 of us.
And going in, what surprised you?
Well, what I didn't expect to see until I got to Geneva for my training was that I would be dealing with rape victims. I had no idea. I didn't even know that was happening in the first place, really, and that I would be expected to deal with those people. And that my job really was sort of a covert way of providing care for the rape victims. The Women's Center was a separate building that we'd set up, and that was because the cultural stigma of being a rape victim was so huge that no one would come to be treated. So what they did was they set up the Women's Center, where you could go if you were pregnant or any other female concern. So someone could say, like, oh, I have a bladder infection, I have a yeast infection. You know, they could make up some sort of story as to why they were there. So that was a big shock to me. I'm not trained, you know, as a psychologist or... and really, I mean, my first day there, I had a 6-year-old rape victim, and that was, I mean, that floored me, but it was a pretty fitting introduction to Darfur.
Amy, when you were in Darfur, you decided to blog about these experiences. I'm just wondering how that was possible, considering the kinds of living conditions that you were in.
We had a satellite phone, and because we needed to be in contact, it's a safety issue. I mean, every day with, you know, headquarters, we got to send and receive emails once a day. So what I did was I would write my stories, and then I would email them to my mom, and she would post them on the blog.
And what was your motivation for blogging?
Because when I was in Afghanistan, I started doing that, and I didn't tell the stories to the full extent of how bad it was there because my family was so worried already, and I was sort of trying to play it down, but the stories that I did tell were really eye-opening and really there's 2 things. One was having come back from the Philippines the first time, and you're so different and you're so changed and people have no idea why. So coming back from Afghanistan, people had a better idea because I'd written all those stories. And they also had an idea of what was going on there, which at the time, you know, people didn't have to get involved because the U.S. was already in there and the allies were in there. In Darfur, I wanted people to know what was really happening because there's so little press about it. So, and, you know, you can read a paragraph that says, like, you know, 200,000 killed and 1.5 million displaced, and that means nothing. So for me to tell stories of real people, and this is happening and people are suffering, and, you know, these are, I don't know, I was trying to put faces to the stories. So it also gave me this false impression that everyone in North America was aware and cared and really, you know, wanted to do a lot, and then coming back here and realizing that people still had no idea what was happening there. So it was really shocking. I really, when I was there, had this idea that people were all involved in doing something because they were the ones who were reading my stories, and so they were the ones I was emailing with. But coming back and finding out that, you know, Tom Cruise is getting 12 times more coverage than Darfur, and I wear my Save Darfur shirt, and people are asking me if Darfur is a band. So it gave me a false impression as to how much the world cared. But I don't know. In some small way, I, you know, did my part. I told the stories that I saw. You know, a lot of people have given a lot of money to MSF because of them.
You're listening to an interview with former student Amy Osborne on CITR 101.9 FM.
Are you a UBC student taking first-year economics, math, chemistry, or physics?
That stuff is hard.
Are you feeling like you need some tutoring? That's okay, because the AMS offers free and appointment tutoring for students in these subjects.
Whoa! How does it work?
It's on a first-come, first-served basis, and there's no need to sign up. Just show up with your books and your questions.
Whoa! When does it happen?
Monday to Thursday from 3 to 7 at the Sub Pacific Spirit Cafeteria, located beside the Starbucks.
Whoa! A+, here I come.
Welcome back to Prof Talk. Here's the second half of my interview with Amy Osborne.
Amy, I'm just wondering how Darfur has changed since you were there in 2006. And I'm wondering if you can tell me a little bit about this.
I know MSF has pulled out, which is huge because they're usually the last ones to leave. You know, the deaths are increasing, especially the children who are malnourished already. When we were there, they had the World Food Program was working there, and the funding had been cut, and the rations had been cut in half. And that was a horrible thing to happen because the rations were barely, you know, hardly enough in the first place. So the people started to be more malnourished, so you get more infection, more deaths. So, you know, it went back up, but now, you know, it's down again, and now it's worse because there's no doctors there, there's no medicine, there's, you know, the pumps are going to run out of fuel eventually, and there won't be clean water.
And Jamie, how are you different than others your age?
I think I'm a lot more serious now. I also, you know, have never been somewhere long enough to think of getting married or having kids. And most of my friends are married and have kids now. My friends who are my age. But I'm just more serious. And I'm probably a lot more passionate just because I know, you know, a little more as far as, you know, what I'm fighting for.
Amy, when you came back from Darfur after working as midwife with MSF, did you get the opportunity to talk to anyone about your experiences and, I mean, what you saw there?
They had me see a psychologist. Been told that everyone who leaves Somalia, Palestine, or Darfur has to see a psychologist, which I thought was pretty fitting. But my team and I met up later, and it turned out that I was the only one that had to. And so I thought that was pretty funny. And I asked my leader, I was like, why didn't you have to? And he's like, you put your feelings on the internet. You know, everyone knew how fucked up you were about it. It's like, you know. But it was also very different talking to someone who works for MSF who gets it. You know, so it's not like coming back here to Vancouver where, you know, they have no idea.
And what do you remember most about when you first came home?
I don't really remember when I first came back. It was such a fog. I spent about 2 months here, and then I left for med school, which was a great distraction. But I know that in that 2 months, I was not a very pleasant person to be around. I was pretty harsh, actually. And really angry, and really... Like, I'm usually pretty even-keeled, so I was pretty quick to fly off the handle in those 2 months. As far as my daily routine, I didn't do much. Like, I was really just sort of making up for 5 months of not sleeping and, you know, 5 months of stress hormones. So
obviously it was really hard to come home. But did you ever actually lose it on anyone when you came home?
I almost lost it on the border patrol lady when I was coming back in at customs. Because I had just come back from the worst experience of my life in the worst situation in the world, and I was exhausted, and I arrive in Canada, and I still had this impression that everyone knows and everyone cares. And she says, where have you been? I say, Darfur. She says, were you there on holidays? And, like, I was incredulous. I just stood there going, are you kidding? Are you kidding? And it was all I could say. And she was so flabbergasted. She was like, what is wrong? And I was like, there's a genocide happening in Darfur right now. Do you actually think I was there on vacation? And she was like, oh, I didn't know that. And then as I was walking away, I heard her turn to one of the other women and being like, did you know there's a genocide in Darfur? But unfortunately, I came back to, you know, most of the country having a response like that. So she was just the first person to make me aware. And then another moment where I couldn't actually react because she was a friend of my sister's, but if you read my blog, you probably read the story where I was had some wine. She asked me about culture shock and coming back, and I was like, hard to come back. You think people care? You come back, find out they don't. It's pretty shocking. And she looks at me. She's like, you got that sweatshirt at the Gap, didn't you? I had the same one. That was her response. Like, here I am talking about, like, coming back from Darfur, where there's a genocide, nobody cares, hard to take. And she makes a comment on my sweater. It's like, awesome. I just like turned around and walked away.
And what was it like to actually leave Darfur?
When I first left there, I felt really guilty that I got to leave, because I knew that my friends that I'd left there weren't ever going to get to leave. And that's a really harsh reality. You know, like, I'm not from here. I'm, you know, from North America, so I get to go home. And if something really bad happens here, the UN's going to come in and get me, but they're not going to take you. You know, so that's really hard to wrap your brain around. When I got home, I was really shell-shocked. For about two weeks, a week and a half, two weeks, I couldn't even talk. Like, I had nothing to say. But I was a little bit expecting it, and I went down to my uncle's cabin in Oregon to get away, and I think that was good. I came back a little more normal, but I think the biggest feeling is just anger. You know, you come back and realize that nobody cares, and you've seen something that's so atrociously beyond comprehension, and then you come back to this.
Amy, for people who have never worked in such situations, is there a way of sort of explaining how you felt, or, I mean, how you dealt with your thoughts when you came home?
Have you ever seen the picture that the photographer took of the starving child with the vulture right beside it? Famous. It's world famous. It was a photographer in, I don't know if it was Ethiopia, it might have been Sudan, and it's this, like, skeletal child who's maybe one and a half or two on the side of the road, and a vulture right beside him waiting for him to die. And the photographer took the picture and then left and came home and 3 months later killed himself. And people's reaction to that picture was, you know, well, what happened to the child? Why didn't you do something? Why didn't you pick him up? Why didn't you? Well, because there was like 10,000 other people on the same road, and there's only one of you, and you can only do so much. And you leave there feeling like, you know, I didn't make a difference at all. So I really understood how he felt when he came home. And I really even had the same thought of, you know, A, it would put me out of my misery, and B, you know, probably the best thing I could do for Darfur would be to come home and do something like that, because it raises so much publicity, you know? And that's a horrible, twisted thought, but you start getting really desperate. And the really sad thing is to have some North American come home and, you know, do something that drastic over it would have gotten more publicity than what's happening over there right now. And people would have been aware. And the thing is, a lot of people who become aware really do care. It's just a matter of them knowing.
Right. Now, onto a little bit of a different topic. I'm just wondering how you think the media covers issues in Darfur.
I think they need, they need more of a human touch to it. I mean, you can put on page 11 in a paragraph like this big a million times that 200,000 to 400,000 people have been killed and 1.5 million displaced. It doesn't mean anything to anyone. People are sitting here and they might skim it. They might even think, wow, that's terrible. It means nothing. They need to have actual stories in there of actual people and names and faces. And, you know, I get that Darfur is closed to reporters, but it's not closed to all of us, you know. You have a huge resource in humanitarian aid workers who actually are on the front lines and see and, you know, talk to them, get their stories. Like, get real stories about real people whose lives are being ruined right now.
Did you find that there was a similar sort of frustration among aid workers in Darfur?
Yeah, because it's not covered. That's the thing. It's not covered. It's not covered. And you have been over there and you're one of the few people that actually knows how awful it is, and you want to tell everyone. You want to tell everyone. Like, I can't even tell you how many times I've written to Oprah and been like, please do a story on Darfur. Please, like, these are some stories. Like, read these, and, you know. And, you know, she could do it. Anyone could do it. So many, I've written to the newspapers, I've written to, like, editors, politicians. Sometimes you'll get, like, a, you know, thank you for your concerns about blah, 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 but it's a form letter. But, for the most part, no, no response.
Why do you think the media aren't picking up on the stories, or the stories that you think should be told?
I don't know. I mean, I kind of, for most part, if things aren't covered in the news, I feel like they think it won't sell. But, I mean, what's happening in Darfur is pretty sensational. Like, they could make it sensational. I mean, if that's what you have to do to get people aware, like, do whatever slant you have to do. Just, like, make people aware of what's going on in their world. Like, we really don't need to know that Tom Cruise is in the closet and married to Katie Holmes has a beard. Really? Is that important? Like, no. Because there's children being raped and, you know, murdered in Darfur every single day. And most people don't know. Even people who are really educated don't seem to know. Or they sort of know, but they don't really know. So, I don't know.
And Amy, what is your hope for, I mean, this sounds a little cheesy, but for future generations? I mean, what would you like to see happen there?
What I'm kind of hoping to do with my generation of friends and my parents' friends is to inspire the people that are going to end up being the leaders of the country, and, you know, that we can get people in there that are compassionate. Like, Obama has been calling for people to intervene in Darfur, you know, since long before it was popular, and now he's the president. And I feel like if it wasn't for the war in Iraq and the economic crisis, he would have done something about Darfur already, but he's a little overwhelmed. So that, I mean, I kind of feel like you have to catch them before they're big and overwhelmed. And if we can get the next generation to really care, then the next generation of leaders is going to care. So, and the thing is, people, the leaders have to know that we care, because they want votes. And they, you know, they decide based on what they think their constituents want. And if people don't say, they don't know. So.
This is my last question. I'm just wondering, what would you tell people who aren't really sure what they can do in places like Darfur? I mean, for the students here at UBC, what sort of things and opportunities are available?
A lot of people think, like, if I'm not a doctor, I can't go, there's nothing I can do. But there's so many things people can do overseas. And I feel like everyone has a passion, whether they know it or not. And they don't have to even go overseas. I mean, you know, my ex-boyfriend's a musician, and he is super passionate about teaching kids music. And, you know, so he can go do it in, like, the inner city in Chicago. Like, there's so many people that need, and especially people like us, because we have so much. We've been given so much, and I think a lot is expected of us. And I don't know. I want to do what I can with my life. Like, I'm only accountable for myself. But my hope is that that will spill over into other people seeing that they can do it too and wanting to do it. And if my pictures and my stories make them care, all the better.
This is my life. I wake up in the morning, I eat, I sleep, I shit.
Breakfast with the Browns.
So whatever it is, but I never shut it off for 5 minutes.
I can't wait to impress my friends with my astounding knowledge of cool.
Join your favorite Brownsters and tune in and listen to the best selection of down-tempo electro-pop loungecore.
Strictly Squaresville.
Remember, subtle, basic, brown.
Breakfast with the Browns
on CITR 101.9 FM every Monday morning
from 8 a.m. to 11 a.m.
The older I get, the more life starts to make sense, and the less I care.
Now we're riding the rainbow, the clouds lift, and we're making it like young. Now we're riding the rainbow to Cloudsville, and we're making it like you. Now we're riding the rainbow to Cloudsville, and we're...
You know, you can give 100 examples of what it isn't, but you, man, you're going to have a hell of a time saying what it is.
You've been listening to Prof Talk on 101.9 FM in Vancouver. You've just heard an interview with former UBC student Amy Osborne. Carrie, thank you very much for being on the show today and for sharing this interview with us.
No worries, Karen. And a big thank you to Amy for sharing her story with us. I hope you all enjoyed it.
And that's it for our show this week. Thank you to Carrie Blackadar for being on the show with us. And of course, a big thank you to our producer, Lex Stoymanoff. If you want to listen to the podcast of today's show, you can find that online at citr.ca, and also check out our blog at ubcproftalk.wordpress.com. We'll be back next Monday morning with another edition of Prof Talk. My name is Karen Moxley. Have a wonderful week, and thank you for listening.